as a special episode of the Dopcast to mark Neurodiversity Celebration Week. We want to talk to colleagues about their experiences with neurodiversity or neurodivergence. So we're here today with Rory and Helen. So would you guys want to give us a quick introduction to yourself, your experience, and how you see the world?
Hi, I'm Helen. The reason why I started learning more about neurodiversity was seeing signs of it in both of my children. Probably about 4 or 5 years that I've been on this journey of learning about autism in particular, just starting the assessment process with one of my children.
Hi, I'm Rory. I describe myself as a closet autistic, in that pretty sure I'm autistic, I've never been formally diagnosed. I'm in the process. That's maybe something we can talk about as this kind of progresses, is the idea that quite a lot of people will identify as being neurodivergent without necessarily having a formal diagnosis, and maybe that's not always the most important thing. But I've probably been going through this journey last maybe 2 years or so. My wife used to sort of suggest it a fair bit. She used to work in a special needs school with a lot of autistic people, but it came out a lot in arguments, so you kind of take that as being more offensive than, you know, something you want to act on. But then I started to take it a bit more seriously, started to look into it, and found out that a lot of different behaviours that I had kind of growing up and sort of into my adult life all kind of seemed to fall under that umbrella, and it was kind of like a kind of shining a light on all of it and kind of realising, actually, yeah, there's something in this. So I've been referred. I've done various tests and I've sort of been referred, but I haven't been formally diagnosed yet. But pretty certain, and having had conversations with lots of other people in the company about it and other like-minded people, there's definitely something going on. So why I want to get involved, what I'm finding is that there's a lack of general support out there. There are things you can do, but there's a lot of hoops you've got to jump through. And for me, it's kind of wanting to start those conversations, start to try and build a bit of a community. We've now got the neurodiversity subgroup of the Accessibility Network, trying to get more support for everybody. So anything I can do really to bring in that support that wasn't there for me, or that isn't there for me now. So that's kind of where I'm coming in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you say about support, because that's why I am trying to get a formal diagnosis for my children, is so they do get the support through school, because I've heard so many stories of adults being diagnosed later in life and they've ended up in psychiatric wards and hospitals as teenagers because it wasn't diagnosed. And obviously nobody wants that for their children. I guess that's the thing. It's in some ways you think, well, does a diagnosis really change anything? But yes, the conclusion I'm coming to is it does, because then people get that support. As Rob has also alluded to, the awareness as well, that people that you work with can be aware of that people are different and think differently and need the environment to adapt so that they can be successful in it.
Feels like there's a little bit of validation attached to it as well, right? So in a way, if I'm asking people to treat me differently, does it feel like I should have more of a formal diagnosis behind me? Possibly. Is that fair? Maybe not. I don't know. But it feels like more legitimate if someone said, yes, you have, but it doesn't change how I'm feeling. It doesn't change. But one thing that I found, this is definitely something you should take away for your kids, is that diagnosis doesn't change that much in terms of the support that's accessible to you. So for autism, there's not a cure. It's not like you're going to write your diagnosis, here's some pills, make it better. That's, you know, not going to happen. The support is, as I'm finding, is freely available already, even in the absence of a diagnosis. And that's one of the mistakes that I made, was almost waiting too long to seek out that support, because I thought that I had to have a formal diagnosis, and it turns out that I don't. And a lot of the support that I've been trying to get is more around sort of mental health support. So I'm going to kind of pull this figure out of the sky, and please don't quote me on it, but something like 80% of people with autism suffer with a corresponding mental health disorder. So that's anxiety, depression, you know, things like that. And so support for those things is available whether you're diagnosed or not. So if you think, and maybe that's, you know, if you want to share it, how we should probably talk about some of the behaviors and how it's manifesting, but if there is support that is needed, don't wait for a diagnosis, because that can take a long time. If you think there's support that they need, go and look at that now.
Yeah, which we've for my daughter in primary school, the school are being supportive, but there's clearly things that she struggles with at school, because as soon as she comes home, she melts down. So school see her as a model pupil who, you know, she's bright as a button, and, you know, they were actually shocked when we told them at school our concerns
because she's
about how distressed she is when she comes home. And I guess that's the issue with trying to get the support at school, is if, like, they're not going to point out a problem to you, and sometimes they don't even see it. My son's now at secondary school. He's the complete opposite. So he gets back from school and he shuts down. I think he's really struggled with that transition, because he's only just went in September. And they won't, you know, they're not really entertaining anything right now, because they don't see a problem. And I think that is the problem. That's where this validation, this thing of, yes, that there is. Problem's the wrong word, but the problem is the environment. It's not the child. It's, there needs to be allowances made for them within the school setting that make it less distressing for them.
It's probably worth exploring, and I'm happy to go first if you'd rather me to, just sort of talking about how it manifests, because you know, there's the phrase, you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, right? Because we're all different. But I'm curious, because I think you spoke to me before when I wrote, I'm going to plug the blog that I've written for next week. When you read that, you said that reminded you a lot of what you see in your son.
Yes.
And I was interested in that. So I wonder if it's worth just having a conversation about how it manifests, both from what you see with your kids and how it is for me. I'm happy to go first with that if you'd rather,
yeah.
I don't mind. There's quite a lot of things. Very prone to anxiety attacks. And I'm actually, yesterday was having a call with, I can't remember the name now, but a service to get support on that. Turns out I'm not anxious enough to warrant support. They've just sent me articles.
Wow.
So yeah, so my wife is, you know, struggling with various behaviors that I'll kind of go into, and she's like, go and get support. So I went and got support. They were like, well, you're a bit anxious, you're a bit depressed, but not enough to warrant therapy. All right, great. So, kind of on my own on that one, which is why I'm trying to set up internal support groups, because, you know, we can all help each other. But yeah, so some mental health issues, sort of, you know, anxiety being the main one. Very routine in the way that I do things. My wife describes me as being a bit of a robot. Sometimes when I'm talking to her about things, she'd be like, you're not at work now. Talk to me like I'm your wife, not, you know. I eat a lot of the same foods a lot of the same times a day, and when I don't, like today, I get really bad stomach cramps and bad problems, to the point where I might not even eat dinner tonight. So we'll go out and we'll all sit and have food and whatever. I might not have anything. And sometimes when I have social events like that, I just really struggle to eat. And I didn't realise until I started looking into it that sort of gastro problems, if you like, are quite common with people with autism. Never realised. I have a lot of trouble regulating feelings of sort of anger and frustration. When you spoke before about your daughter having meltdowns and people kind of manifest in different ways, I can get very verbal, very shouty, very kind of frustrated and angry. And I've described it as feeling like someone's turning a screw into my brain when that's happening. Like, it's really, really bad. And the behaviours off the back of it aren't great either. But things can just cause meltdowns. I'm very hyper-focused on certain things. So someone, I can't remember who it was, but shared in one of our neurodiversity group chats about monotropism, this idea that, and this described me really well, this idea that for someone who's autistic, it can take more effort to focus on certain things, and you focus on less things as a result, which is very true, because I've been sort of fixated on certain individual things, but then when other things are brought into that, it can become very overwhelming. So I constantly say to my wife, you give me too much, just kind of back off a little bit. Because I might be, like, if she's started to run a bath for my daughter, but I've stepped in to carry on, there's like a certain set of steps I know I need to do. Everything needs to be in a certain, you know, I've got to get nappies out, I've got to get her clothes, I've got to do this and the other. If she's done part of it, I come upstairs, I can feel quite lost. because I'm like, right, well, I don't know what's been done because I haven't been through that checklist in my brain. And then if I'm trying to get on top of that and she brings me something else, I'm like, no, it's too much. You've got to just give me a minute. And I can be quite abrupt just when I'm like that, because I'm just like, go away, you know, which isn't great. Like yesterday, so I knew I was driving up here this morning, and so I was going to bed really early, and I had a meeting that was going to run till 4:45. So I was like, right, finish my meeting, we'll all have dinner, I'll get all my stuff ready for going out today, and then wife can bath my daughter, take care of that, that's all sorted. The meeting overran, and towards the back end of it, my brother-in-law came over, which I wasn't expecting, to fix a chest of drawers that he built for us. So all of a sudden, I finished work late, dinner's not ready, and someone's in the house I wasn't expecting. And I was completely lost. Just couldn't process it. I was thinking about this morning. I felt like a sat nav that was, you know, when you go a different direction, it's calculating and it takes a minute to figure out the new route. I was literally like that.
Wow.
So yeah, it was, I was just lost for a few minutes. Just had to figure out all the things I was going to do in a new order. So there's yeah, loads of different ways it manifests. So yeah, a little bit broken.
But yeah, reading your blog, I did notice a lot of my son in that, and that there was a line in it that really made me laugh about anybody who doesn't agree with me.
Stupid.
I think that's stupid. That's so him. He has very fixated interests, so he'll be absolutely obsessed with certain subjects. It's typically motorsport, trains and theatres, which is an absolute bizarre combination, but that's what he likes, and he just is quite closed off to anything else. And we're all right with that now. We've got past this thing of, oh, broaden your interests. Like, well, no, if that's what he's happy doing, that's what he's gonna do. But it, like you said, it's like there's no room for anything else, and you can be talking to him and you'll like try and or you'll be talking about something else, and he will, in the middle of the conversation, just put something out there that's completely irrelevant, because that's what was in his head. So yeah, he's very very fixated on things. Loves a plan. Gotta know what we're doing, where we're going, what we're doing next. Since he went to secondary school, he seems to shut down a bit more. So he'd used to have these periods where he'd say, "All right, we're going to do something," and he wouldn't be happy about it. And obviously, like kids do, they moan about it. But usually when you got somewhere and you'd got into the day, he'd snap out of it pretty quickly, and he'd find something that would spark his interest and get him out of his low mood. Whereas lately he doesn't. He just stays in it, and you just cannot get him out of it. It's just, I want to go home, I want to be in my bedroom. I think he takes sanctuary, you know, be surrounded by his things. He likes collections, he collects Lego. Yeah, he's got a wall of speed champions. He's obsessed. So yeah, he's more quiet, shuts down. My daughter's complete opposite. So what first sort of alerted us to there might be something that wasn't just like typical toddler tantrums is when she was about four. So she's just coming up to like nursery age, go to reception at school. She wasn't a tantrumy toddler, but then she seemed, at my ignorance at the time, I referred to them as tantrums because that's what I thought it was. So instead of like everything starting to chill out at that age, it was getting worse, and she was seeming to just get angry and shouty and screamy about lots of things. She's always been a fussy eater. I say fussy again, I don't like using that word, because now I know that she's not being fussy. Mm-hmm. It genuinely is a problem. And yeah, she never slept well, which is can be another sign. And she's never liked her hair brushing. She's had her hair cut. She's 6 years old. She's had her hair cut once, very long. So yeah, that combination of not wanting it cut and not letting me brush it very often is a bit of a problem. Lots of plaits. She doesn't like brushing teeth, so sensory
feeling
things.
Cool. So we both talked about kind of the things you saw. What sort of things does it help with potentially? A lot of people say there's superpowers in there. Is there anything that you guys see that are, you know, make a benefit to your life as well?
The hyper-focus thing can be quite useful, like this morning. Okay, so it's been well enough people have spoken about this now that I don't feel like I'm telling everybody. So I live in Cornwall. This has been done in Roman House. I didn't come up just for this, but there's a 330-mile drive this morning that I had to go through. Everyone else I speak to is like, oh my God, that's so much driving. Like, oh, that's really bad. I was kind of mentally preparing for this as early as Tuesday to Thursday now. So by Tuesday evening, I started to kind of mentally get into the zone, and it just ultimately just became something I had to do. And then while I was driving, just kind of snapped in the zone, no problem. Absolutely fine with the drive, like not an issue at all. It makes me a very good problem solver. I think it helps me as my job as an analyst, because people come to me with problems all the time, and I've also got a very vivid internal monologue and can picture things in my brain very clearly. So when we're doing design work and talking about ideas for dashboarding or reports or whatever, I'm very good at formulating that picture in my head before I've, you know, written it down or done whatever, which I think is very, very helpful as well. So there are good things. It's just at the moment there's a lot of bad things that kind of overshadow that. So sometimes when people go, oh yeah, but what's good? It's like, well, yeah, okay, there are things that help, but you know what, on the balance of play, I'd probably rather not be in this position right now. That might change later on, but at the moment, it doesn't feel like there's a great deal for me to celebrate about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just, you know, that's just where I am.
Anything on your side, Helen?
I'd say my daughter's, as I said, she seems to be doing so well at school. She's only six, her reading is mind-blowing, her maths. How could she do that? You know, it's like, and it is, it's incredible, but yeah, I'd kind of wish that she didn't have all this distress. She obviously finds it distressing being at school, even though she obviously takes lots in and can process that very quickly. What you said about having the vivid imagination, I actually think that at the moment is a frustration for him, because he can't execute what's in his head.
Right.
So, like I said, he loves Lego, so he'll have he can picture what he wants to build, and if he can't replicate that, then that's something he's really struggling with at the moment. So, yeah, completely relate to that, but it's, yeah, probably more of a curse at the
mm-hmm.
moment.
Yeah, it's kind of, the impact it has on you mentally is quite draining a lot of the time, because, and one of the things I always say is that when I'm at my worst and most difficult, it's because that's when I'm struggling the most, and when I'm struggling just to process everything that's going on. And it would be nice if, you know, I don't want to use the word, but I'm kind of have to, if I could just be a bit more normal, like if that wasn't a thing. But I'm interested to get your take, Helen, on how have other people responded sort of in your life and sort of that you know, in terms of how they've then sort of subsequently treated your children, knowing that this is a thing. Because for me, one thing that I found is, I use the analogy of, if I was in a wheelchair, people would see that I was in a wheelchair, they would have certain expectations of what I could and couldn't do, and they would treat me accordingly. They wouldn't, you know, if I was in a wheelchair, I wouldn't be judged on my ability to walk up the stairs. Okay, but because what we've got is neurological and affects behaviours and how we are perceived outwardly by other people, it's much harder to, for lack of a better phrase, like I tell my wife sometimes, I just need you to calm me down and give me a hug, even though, and I cannot stress enough, this is metaphorical, even though I'm punching her in the face, right? I'm like going, really going at her, like shouting, screaming, and because I'm struggling. And in that moment, I'm like, that's when I need you to look after me the most, and that's really difficult,
yeah.
You know? And what I find is that everyone's like really on board with, yeah, we want to help you, we want to support you, want to whatever. And then when I'm being really difficult, that goes out the window very quickly and people don't know what to do. Have you found anything kind of similar with your kids?
Not really, because I think they only melt down with the people they feel the most comfortable with.
Yeah,
that's me. And but they're at home, but my mum, she looks after them quite a bit. So my mum's lucky as well. She we get to share the joy. I would think that, see, my dad's, you know, I still think my dad struggles with it a bit, that, you know, his generation would refer to as a tantrum,
mm-hmm.
and acting like a spoiled brat. And we have to accept, you know, that's typically what parents thought when I was growing up. But my dad's a bit more hands-off. It's like my mum does all the caring for them when they're with them. But I can still look at him sometimes and I think, you actually think she's being a little... You know what I mean? You
mm-hmm.
just know that's the thing. And it might sound very strange me saying that about my own dad, but I'm very pragmatic and not realistic about these things, is you're not going to change his perception
yeah.
of what a spoiled child looks like, because that's just what's drummed in, isn't it, when,
mm-hmm.
for that generation, that any child that behaves like that is, well, spoiled. You've been too easy on them. But I'd say anybody who kind of really does the primary care for the kids, like myself, my mum, my partner, yeah, we all get it. We've gone past that stage of, you know, thinking that they somehow can control this behaviour, because they absolutely cannot. People outside of immediate family, the jury's out there. You know, I feel judged quite a lot of the time if my daughter does anything in public. With my son, you know, he can seem quite rude and abrupt at times. And before, I'd be like thinking, oh no, you can't say that. And now I'm like, you know what? Doesn't matter. Just if that's how you feel, you know, because you're like, you're trying to spare somebody else's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, their feelings don't really matter to me because I don't know them. His do matter to me. So if he wants to pull a face because he's trying to express dissatisfaction with something, then if somebody wants to take that the wrong way, that's fine. But yeah.
I think that's great. I have exactly the same thing, and I've been told enough times that I come across as being that kind of way. Especially if in a working context, if I think something should be done a certain way and people disagree with me, then I know I can be quite like, you know, this is how it should be done.
Mm.
You know, and it's really funny because then that comes out as like, you know, my wife said, you know, you've been really rude to my parents. Like, when? Like, I don't recognise it. I was having a chat the other day with someone, and I at the end of the meeting, I apologised. I was like, I can almost hear myself as I've had this conversation with you. And I know I've been quite abrupt and quite sharp and whatever it is, because kind of I care about what we're doing. I want it to be right. And this is just, I'm almost having to process in real time that you don't have the same point of view as me. Which sounds like a really bizarre thing to say, because we all know that not everyone's going
to
be the same.
It's natural to some people to be able to do that, though.
Yeah, but to be able to have this really strong, kind of like what you're saying with your son, to have this really strong image of how you think something should be, and then someone say, actually, I want to do it this way, and then that image has to shift and change away from what you originally envisaged. That can be quite challenging in real time while having a conversation, because you've got to process that thought and then try and be polite in the process about it. And that is super difficult, you know. I have all sorts of things, like I'll make a lot of jokes, because, and I think this is my equivalent of masking. I talked to my wife about this the other day, because I didn't really know what masking was, but I, you know, brought up in, you know, around groups of lads, and my parents used to kind of wind me up a lot and whatever, and I think I've just grown up thinking that's how people treat each other. But I'm often told that the jokes I make at people's expense are quite rude, and I don't realise. And I'm like, I don't understand, because you guys do that. And when they do that to me, I feel like I'm being personally attacked, which can be quite distressing. So I'm like doing the same thing back to people, thinking I'm doing what they're doing. And then my wife could be like, that was really rude when you said that. And I was like, was it? the other day, so my father-in-law was really incredibly handy, built his own extension, you know, whatever.
Wow.
He's helping us out with some of our house. And he come and did a bit of work on the electrics, and, you know, he did something that maybe wasn't quite right or whatever. And I was like, oh, you know, these electricians coming in and whatever. Obviously joking, right? And afterwards, I was in the car, my wife, she was like, that was really rude. Like, don't do that again. And I was like, what did I do? He's like, well, you come to help us and you've said that. And I'm like, it's obviously a joke. Like, I appreciate what he's doing so much. And she was like, no. That you don't get how you came across. And that can be really frustrating, because I'm trying to... I've said it within my team. I think this is a really important thing at work, right? I've talked to the people within the team that I work with. If I'm being a certain way, pull me aside and tell me. Because I don't mean it. There's nothing behind it. And I'll be the first person to put hands up and go, yeah, fair enough. getting people to actually do that is a whole other thing. So I said to my wife, you know, if I've said something that's upset your parents, why won't they tell me? Like, because it's really awkward. You know, they don't want to just do that. They don't know what they can. And I'm like, but how am I supposed to, how are we supposed to grow together if we don't do that? Like, you've got to give me the chance to, you know, push back and say, I didn't mean that. You know, if that's upset you, sorry. I'll try not to do it next time. But I almost don't realize I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be quite difficult. So yeah, the way sort of it causes me to interact with people can be quite frustrating. But to be fair, we talk about the workplace side of it. The guys on the team have been great. You know, a couple of people have on occasion pulled me aside and said, you know, maybe you didn't mean it this way or whatever, but you were a certain way. I'm like, yep, okay, fine, sorry, didn't mean to, like, whatever. And it's all kind of understood that I can be a certain way. It's not ideal, I don't want to be that way, but at the same time, it's kind of like what you were saying about controlling it. It's like, well, if I'm wired in that way, how do I stop myself being like that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to be.
It's like, do we ask you to change to fit in with the workplace, or actually is it more that this workplace needs to adapt slightly to allow you to
thrive
in it?
I think it's both, right? So I describe it as wanting to be better for the world that I live in, and I want the world I live in to be better for me.
Yeah.
So it's got to be kind of, there's got to be a meeting in the middle. There has to be kind of a level of tolerance and acceptance for how I can be as a person, things that affect me, and, you know, this is not just me, but for everybody who has, you know, similar conditions. But then equally, I have to be aware that I can be a certain way and be the first person to go, yeah, sorry, didn't mean it. Like, I didn't intend to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's that can be quite challenging, those kind of building those personal relationships. I once had someone in the office in a different job say, yeah, it's all right, we're used to how you are, but other people who've not met you before maybe don't. And that was before I was, you know, going through this journey, so, yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, it's not just neurodivergent people who might be a certain way at work. You know, you have to accept that there will be some people who don't speak to people very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
and I guess this thing about you feeling you want to be told when you've upset somebody, or, you know, it's like with children, you've sort of, a lot of people I've been following in this area say that the worst thing you can actually do is talk about something after the event. So let's say there's been a big meltdown, is you don't actually say anything about it, because it's likely that that person is already feeling a great sense of shame, so they don't want to be shamed anymore by talking about it. And I guess, yeah, I think it's a similar thing. It's like, well, if people know that, you know, certain people they work with might sometimes come across a bit abrupt when they don't mean to, then yeah, can't we all just say, right, that's the way it is, and move on, and not sort of like pick up every time it happens? Because again, it's that thing of, yeah, it's just, it is the way it is. I think there might be exceptions to that if it was quite an extreme. But I'd say for minor things where it's somebody's tone of voice you might have thought was a bit off. I've had that. I've had it where somebody's spoken to me in a way where I've been a little bit like, that was a little bit off. But then I've got on with my day and not thought any more about it. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that can happen with any, whether it's neurodivergent or,
yeah,
or not.
There's almost got to be like a level of accepted being a bit of a tool. Like, I think
there
comes
a
point. I'm just trying to I'm autistic, what do you want? I'm just trying to think about it in a, if I got pulled up on everything,
yeah,
it would be exhausting for everyone. Right. And so there's got to be a point where certain things just, and my wife's getting good at that. I know it bothers her sometimes when I'm a bit snappy with something, or, you know, a certain response, but by and large, you know, it's a lot of things kind of go. But then when something big happens, we, you know, make sure we do try and talk about it. And a lot of the time it's, well, how did that happen? You know, what were the events that caused it to happen? What could we have done differently? How can we stop this happening again? Because we don't want to, especially I've got, you know, toddler in the house. She doesn't want to see me melting down. And I don't want her to emulate that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of things like, one thing I always talk about is, and this might be really good for you with your kids, is when meltdowns are coming on, and your daughter will probably get to a point where she becomes more conscious of the fact that it's approaching. Because I can, you know, tell you on a scale how I'm feeling at any point in time. and you'll melt down at a 9 or a 10, but there's like a process to get there. Sometimes that process is very quick, but there is a process, and you can start to become more aware of moving in that direction. And so one thing I talked to my wife about is escalation. You know, like if I'm at a 4 or a 5, and I'm saying, you might need to back off here, it's don't meet me head on, because if you meet me head on, I'm going to go up to an 8 or a 9, and that's when it's going to get worse. So sometimes it's just a case of, and this is frustrating for her, because she's like, but if I'm angry at you, or if I've got a problem with you, and I want to tell you, and you're telling me, don't say a word because you're about to explode, she's like, where do I put, like, what do I do? But like the other day, I'd been food shopping and taken her car out, and next morning I opened the curtains, saw that I've left a car boot open. Not only have I left a car boot open, there's been a storm.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I'm in trouble, right? But I realised very quickly, I'm like, okay, I've got the same concerns that she's got, right? I want to make sure the car's okay. I want to make sure that it gets closed, that nothing's wet, nothing's a problem. So we're both in the same position in that, but then she's also having a go at me for it. And I'm like, obviously this was a mistake. Didn't do it on purpose. Everything's fine. Can we just let it go? And she's obviously like, no, I'm really annoyed. And I had to be like, you've got to back off, because you're pushing me too hard on this. And if you don't back off, then I'm gonna have a meltdown over this, and it's gonna get 10 times worse. And so that's not a nice conversation to have. But by being more aware that that's coming, you can prevent it more often. I don't enjoy being in that position, and it's not, I wish it didn't happen at all, but it's learning to try to sort of cope with that and stop it from happening.
Yeah, we discovered a couple of people, a child psychiatrist, and I can't remember what the other person's official title is, a woman called Eliza Fricker, who has done a couple of books on her childhood of undiagnosed autism.
Wow.
She's an illustrator, but she's also does some counselling as well, I believe. And she partnered with another lady called Naomi Fisher, who they've created this series of webinars that they call Low Demand Parenting. And it's about their experiences of bringing up their own autistic children, which for me has been a real comfort, because you can read lots of books about it, but when somebody's actually in front of you and been through this themselves and actually has practical advice on how to bring up a child that's neurodivergent, it makes a massive difference. But this concept of low demand is about basically removing, you know, when you're at a 4 or 5, it's not putting any more demand on the child. So it's like being as low demand as you possibly can be. And some of that can be like, if you think about a child getting ready for school in the morning, it's all a demand. Have breakfast, get dressed, brush your hair, brush your teeth. And we see these things, or I see these things, as just, it's a simple thing, you've just got to do it every morning. But to them, it's a demand, and these demands are building. And so yeah, we're trying to do that, is to stop things escalating. As I say, the issue is when they come home from school and they're already at a 9, there isn't really a lot you can do.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm keen to really get into the school day and think, what can change there? How can we take the demand off them?
Well, I definitely find that for me it's exacerbated by being hungry or tired. And when I'm both, it's a lot worse. And I think a lot of that, coming back to monotropism, is thinking, well, the more low on energy I am, either being hungry or being tired or both, it takes even more effort to focus on those one thing or that two things. So then something else comes in, whether it's being asked to do something that I wasn't expecting, or taking criticism for something, or whatever it is, it just becomes 10 times worse because I just haven't got the capacity. And so it comes out as like an explosion rather than, you know, something that a normal person would just get on with. And that can be quite difficult. And so this is, I kind of think it leads nicely into some of the stuff that we're trying to do within the new sort of neurodiversity group that we've put in place. Because one of the things that was big for me was around that support. both for people in my position, people in your position. You know, it's not just I'm affected by it because I have it and I need support, but you're affected by it because you have children who've got it and you need to understand more about what they're going through so you can help them, but also so you can get yourself through it, because I think parents and carers are kind of almost like an unrepresented party in this, right? Everyone, you know, says, oh, this person with autism or ADHD or whatever, it must be really tough for them. But, you know, trying living with someone who's got it, it's not great for them either. You know, they didn't ask for that person to have that problem, and now they've got to deal with it, cope with it, and whatever. So we're really big on trying to get as many people who are affected by neurodiverse issues, the word, conditions, whatever, to try to foster wider understanding and to try to offer that support. So if I can help you understand what your son's going through, because I can, you know, tell you what it's like for me, and I can say what helps for me and what I need from other people to help me through that stuff, then that has an impact on you. And if it's someone who's, you know, child's newly diagnosed, they don't know anything about it, and we've got people like that in our group at the moment, then we can turn around and go, all right, well, I can share my experiences, these people can share their experiences, we've got a bunch of resources, we can support each other. We don't need to depend on, you know, the NHS or Bupa or whatever else is out there, because we can use real life experience of our own conditions and the conditions of people that we live with to help each other through this process. And I think that's really important.
I think that's a really nice place to call it. So I guess last thing really, if you could say one more thing, or if there's one thing to remember from the podcast, what would you want people to take away from it?
That when I'm at my worst, it's because I'm struggling the most, and that's something that is very difficult to bear in mind, but it's something that people should be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the same, but from my perspective, when my kids are at their, well, I say their worst, but you know, when it's hard for them, it's hard for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, coming into work day after a night of meltdowns can be pretty exhausting.
Yeah, I think from listening to both of you, for me, it's you don't need a diagnosis yourself. You don't need to have necessarily the symptoms yourself. It could be in your family, but for everyone just to be aware that everyone's going through their own challenges, their own set of stuff, that people in our teams might need different things or might need different levels of management or leadership or things like that, and just to be more aware of it and keep educating ourselves. So thank you.